Okay, great. Thanks. Can everybody hear me all right? I believe in the 14 or so years I've known Thomas, this is the first time he's been more casually dressed than I have, so kudos to you, sir. What I'd like to do is, I'd like to tell you about the 107th Timberwolf Battalion, but what I'd really like to do, rather than do this, is I have more questions than answers, I guess, to my history colleagues. I was about to give a very simple talk on racism in the military and how the 107th Battalion was shunted into a certain position in the war. But actually, just a few months ago, there was an article published in Native Studies Review that challenged all of that. So right now, I actually have more questions. This is my terminal clause here, some lingering questions a century later. So I'll be bringing up these questions, I guess, to you folks. Another thing I'd like to do is, again, with my history colleagues, about 10 days ago, I was in Ottawa doing a presentation with Mark Phillips at the Canadian Historical Association, and his book was about historical distance. And so it was, how do you explain to students, like, do you use big statistics? Like, you know, do you go high, or do you talk about individuals? And so with this this article that was printed in Native Studies Review a couple months ago, honestly, that high perspective, I'm not really sure anymore. Like, we're going to have to all go back to the drawing board, those of us who are interested in this. But what I will share with you is some individual stories of members from the 107th. And you can see this is the logo of the 107th Timberwolf Battalion. Now, what we know and what we don't, okay? I believe Ian mentioned 4,000 First Nations soldiers in the First World War. Okay. My friend David Miller just heard Joseph Boyden talking about Three-Day Road up in Saskatoon about 2 weeks ago. He said it could have been as high as 60,000. So the 4,000 number comes from Duncan Campbell Scott talking about Treaty Indians. Then we have non-status Indians, we have Métis people, we have a full gamut of identities that we don't really know about. So how's this for a question? Somewhere between 4,000 and 60,000. Okay. Another sort of myth that I maintained for a little while as I was preparing for this was, were First Nations people initially barred from service? So I'll get into that in a little bit, because the prevailing myth was that First Nations people, because of racism in the military and the, upper echelons of the military, they were just too racist. But we'll address that in a few slides. And again, once in, were First Nations soldiers marginalized? And again, I've been forced to go back to the drawing board. I guess this is a good thing about history and historiography, we get to change our minds once in a while. Okay. Now, this is kind of an iconic image, and again, you can see racism and Indian status. This is an ad for the Canadian Patriotic Fund. The Canadian Patriotic Fund was a private pool of money that was gathered up to support the families of soldiers who were overseas in the war. And this poster became quite iconic because this gentleman, Muchi Iwinis from Meadow Lake, donated $150 of his own money. He said that he was partially blind, he couldn't go, he wished he could go, and that's what those two letters are. And the people from the Patriotic Fund were so impressed with that, they turned it into an advertisement. Now, one interesting little thing was the Canadian Patriotic Fund, like I said, it was a private fund, it wasn't a government organization. The families of First Nations fighters were not eligible to get money from the Patriotic Fund until well into the First World War. I think it was the end of 1917. So this gentleman was donating to a cause that his people couldn't even take advantage of. So that's one aspect. Here's another one that kind of got me, and I apologize for this. This is my first paper having been done with iPhone technology. Okay, this is a recruiting ad from Quebec. Okay, Canadien, venez l'exemple. And what it is they're summoning the spirit of Dallard des Ormeaux, one of the founders of New France, and he's actually fighting Indigenous people. So they're portraying, like in French Canada, Indigenous people are portrayed as the enemy. So coming as an outsider, like I said, I'm not a military historian, I appreciate the chance to speak about this, but coming as an outsider, one of my questions is, why enlist? Like, why would First Nations people be driven to this? And actually, in my research, James Dempsey, son of Hugh Dempsey, in his 1999 book that was published by Canadian Plains Research Centre, actually posited three potential ideas. And the first one was an opportunity for the warrior spirit to resurface. So it was a chance for young indigenous men who'd grown up on reserves with tales of warfare and glory and all those other things, and also the secret societies in those communities, for them to dip into that pool of bravery and again to return to tradition. Now, I'm sure that was part of a factor. Just one little vignette here. On the return of soldiers to Paiapot Reserve, not too far from from the Qu'Appelle Valley, the community wanted to organize a Sundance. But of course, at that time, Sundances were illegal. So the Indian agent gave a one-time only dispensation for the community to have a Sundance to honor the returning soldiers on the grounds that no other communities were invited. Okay, so I'm sure First Nations men on returning, if they survived, were held in high esteem in their communities. But that's a very interesting sort of relationship with the state. Another one, an expression of long-standing relationship with the Crown, and I wrote not necessarily Canada. Here's an example of that. Six Nations Reserve, which is near Brantford, was founded by Joseph Brant, who was a commander in the American Revolutionary War, and actually Six Nations people were exiled from New York and were led to southern Ontario. At the beginning of World War I in 1914, the community raised $1,500 and proposed to send a unit of men to go fight for England, not Canada. Okay, so they had a direct tie, probably stemming from Joseph Brant. Okay, and the Canadian government said no. But there were actually quite a few indigenous soldiers from Six Nations. They actually had a largely indigenous battalion of their own. I think it was the 37th Haldimand Regiment. Another one was possibly an escape from the monotony and confinement of reserve life. Okay, as we probably know these days, residential schools were in place, the reserves were very moribund, there was nothing going on. But I actually use confinement, I chose that word carefully because from 1885 to 1951, treaty Indians were actually confined to their reserves if they didn't have a pass such as this. So if this gentleman here from 1932 at Duck Lake was allowed off his reserve to go big game hunting for 2 weeks. So again, the question is why would somebody, there must have been so much goodwill on the part of First Nation soldiers, or they wanted to get the hell out of their communities as badly as possible. Now, the question of the ban, that has been, it's been a long-standing myth. It's been a myth since I've been looking into this topic for the last couple of years. And there was an article, actually Richard Holt wrote the article in 2014, and what he said was, it was never an official policy. Sam Hughes, who is one of the preeminent forces in the development of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, wrote a memo, and what he said was, we don't think this is a good idea. And what he said in this memo was that we're very concerned because if a First Nation soldier is ever captured, we don't know what the consequences will be from the other side. And I've got here, just to remind me, there's a case of William Lickers, who was a Six Nations soldier who was captured at the Battle of Ypres. And he was taken to a prisoner of war camp. And as a First Nations person, he was actually tortured by the Germans. He survived, but he was paralyzed. And according to his testimony, he was paralyzed because the Germans were actually trying to find out, trying to see if he felt pain. That's sort of the level of, misunderstanding, I guess. So what Holt said was, this is probably paternalism rather than flat-out racism. And during the time when the so-called ban, which many of us sort of believed in, there were actually hundreds of First Nations soldiers that volunteered for different units. Another thing to think about is we've been hearing through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission about all the terrible things that happened at residential schools. Well, I'm kind of ambivalent about this, but one of the disciplinary measures, or one of the things they used to instill discipline in the young people, was military training. So many residential schools actually had cadet units. This is one from St. Paul's on the Kainé Reserve in southern Alberta. So when the war started, there were actually quite a few indigenous young people, young men, who were trained in military drill, who were ready to roll with regard to service. And they volunteered actually in quite large numbers. So that dispels the myth that they were actually banned. Okay? Also, again, you know, my question, why enroll? Some communities actually got very deeply involved, even here on the home front. And you can see here, this is my cut and paste job of the File Hills Indian Colony Band having a concert to raise money for the poor people of Belgium. And I just remind you how what kind of poverty the people at the File Hills Colony in the early 20th century were experiencing. They were working to raise money to send to Europe. Okay? That photo on the right is actually the File Hills Red Cross group. Okay? And you can see they're all in traditional dress. But what they were doing was they were raising money for the Red Cross. Now, File Hills is a very interesting community. This was the experimental colony. Mark and I will be talking about that sometime soon. And they were under the direct supervision of a very influential Indian employee named William Graham. You can see him. He's the conspicuous white person in the middle of that photo, if you take a look. And what he did was, because he was so involved in the File Hills colony, he managed to get people so stirred up with regard to patriotism that 24 of 38 able-bodied men in the community actually volunteered for service. So they had a very high representation, and this was quite early on in the war. I'll get back to Graham's contribution to Indigenous affairs in a couple of slides. Before I move on straight to the 107th, I'd just like to make a little shout out to the 188th. I sound like a legionnaire up here talking about all these battalions, but the 188th Battalion was actually another highly Indigenous unit based in Prince Albert, but many of the Treaty 4 reserves, the Soto reserves up in the parklands, like Cote and whatnot, actually they volunteered in very high numbers. We haven't heard much about the 188th because when they went to England, they were broken up as reinforcements for other units, and that's sort of the fate of many of the units that were set up later. Now, getting to the 107th, the man on the left in the very Russian-looking hat after hearing Thomas's talk, that was the Lieutenant Colonel, Glenn Campbell. And you can see on the right, his son, Jack Campbell. So Glenn Campbell was a lifelong Tory. Actually, his father was a fur trader at Fort Ellis, grew up on the frontier, married an Indigenous Soto woman. Okay, you can see his son is obviously mixed race or Aboriginal. Okay, and what Campbell's vision was he wanted to set up not necessarily an Indigenous battalion, but a frontier battalion, a people made up of hunters and bushwhackers and different people with that type of skills. And I won't be one of those guys who reads his slides, but where Campbell got the idea was he had briefly served in Bolton Scouts in 1885. That's an image of sort of the irregular unit, the Bolton Scouts, who were raised, I guess, by, among the white frontiers people of the Northwest Territories in 1885. And I'll just read one thing. I believe that a body of Indians from different tribes would be glad to go with me for scouting and guerrilla warfare. They could not be beaten. The main point is that I want to go with a corps of irregular cavalry. So he had proposed this right at the beginning of the First World War. Now, the generals didn't want an Indigenous unit, like they, for many, many reasons. But Campbell kept with it. And actually, at the beginning of November 1915, his unit, the 107th, was authorized, like they were established. Now, there's been a lot of controversy, and I'm not sure if I can actually retract my abstract I gave Ian about a year and a half ago, but another thing the Holt article does was it questions the number 500 out of 800. No one's really sure because nobody's really looked deep enough. Like, that's probably a good project for a master's student. Anyhow, he did manage to get 1,700 volunteers, or 700 of those people were rejected. Tuberculosis was a terrible problem, especially with First Nations with First Nations recruits. And like I said, number of Aboriginal recruits, we're not really sure. It was in the hundreds for sure. And this is just an image at Camp Sam Hughes, not too far from Winnipeg. Here's an interesting situation. So just yesterday, as I'm looking for some of these images to finish, I realized that the Winnipeg Free Press had a very long article about the 107th Timberwolves with a whole bunch of images, including this one. So kudos to the Winnipeg Free Press. I poached that one from them. Yeah, and this is This is them on their way probably to the train station, and this is their parade out of town as a unit. Okay? Now, once they got to England, they was originally set up as an infantry battalion. Okay? And they were designated a pioneer battalion. And you can see that that gentleman is chopping an incredibly large tree with one axe. And what's been portrayed with forestry battalions, indigenous units have been forestry battalions, railway battalions, and whatnot. James Dencey said that it was a sad testimony that all of these soldiers who signed up earnestly and were ready to roll in the fight for their king and country ended up doing things like chopping wood and building railways. Okay, so that's been the prevailing myth, but I've got another interpretation, actually, from Holt. And what he said was, the pioneers were actually a unit that were a cut above their infantry counterparts. Because what many of them, what they did was, they were infantry, they had rifles, but they also had shovels, and they had light engineering equipment. And their job was, and we'll see this in a couple of slides, when there was an attack, when people went into no man's land, the 107th and other pioneer battalions, their job was to dig trenches and to, as they're fighting, to dig trenches to improve communication lines from the old front line to the new front line. So it was a very dangerous job, and we'll see some of the mortality figures in a minute. That's just an image of some of the officers, and actually they had a very few indigenous officers, but there were a few Six Nations officers. Now, another aspect that I just learned from the Holt article was that having the pioneer designation, okay, because they had to earn it, they had to be trained in England as pioneers, that actually saved the 107th as a unit. And what the backstory of this is, when the unit arrived in England, the front lines were all occupied. I believe, I'm just checking here, I'm not a military historian, there were four complete divisions on the front line. So any of those units that came at the time, this would be, I guess, the fall of 1916, those units tended to be broken up and they were used for reinforcements in pre-existing units because the casualty rates were so high. Campbell had such devotion to his people, I guess. What he did was he volunteered their services as a construction battalion, and he got them into a training school which kept the unit together. And as Tim Weingard said in his book, this was the last complete unit from Western Canada to join the Canadian Corps. So it was actually Campbell's leadership and his commitment to his soldiers that kept them together rather than having them break apart as basically reinforcements. The first action they saw was at Vimy, and what their job was, in the midst of the battle, and like I said, they went over the top, and then their job was to bury cable, improve communications through no man's land. So very dangerous job. They're fighting, and then they're also trying to do something in addition to fighting. Hill 70 was probably their greatest action. There's actually been an article written specifically about that. And as an outsider, I'm blown away by this image because you can see the front line has hardly moved in 4 years. Someone who's new to military history and new to the investigation of the First World War, I'm blown away by this, actually. So at Hill 70, like I said, the 107th was like the second line to go up over the top. And what their job was, to dig ditches as far as 500 yards into no man's land, where they were gassed. In 2 days, 21 men were killed, and this is out of probably 500 or 600, so the mortality rate was very high, 140 wounded. As they were ordered to step back from the front line and take a break, there was actually a couple of companies that volunteered to go out into no man's land again and to search for the wounded. And they did this over the night of of August 17th. They brought back 30 dead soldiers, but also 25 wounded. At that time, over the course of that night, those men too were gassed, and 84 men were poisoned. So they volunteered for that. They didn't have to do it. Hill 70, I just discovered this, was the first use of mustard gas in warfare. So the soldiers would not have been prepared for this, and I don't know if that's actually a 107th Timber Wolf, but you can see the terrible effect of mustard gas. They were also at Passchendaele, and that image on the right is, I don't know if that's 107th, but that's a pioneer battalion, And what they're doing is they're basically surveying a road through the mud. And you can just see how terrible that would have been. And part of their job is to establish communication. So they're digging trenches, they're doing all kinds of stuff. They were also at Cambrai. I've just got a couple images. And most of my work is in the 19th century and earlier. So one thing in researching this paper was I was fascinated by the visual record from the First World War. I guess people working in the 20th century might not be surprised at that, but some of these images are haunting but beautiful at the same time. And you just see Cambrai again. Now, through so Cambrai, Passchendaele, and Vimy all took place in probably, I don't know, 6 month span in 1917. In October 1917, Lieutenant Colonel Campbell died of kidney failure. Like, he didn't die in battle. He was a 52-year-old man, and he was sick and died. That probably spelled the end of the 107th as a distinct unit, because in the spring, once the weather warmed up, they were disbanded into the 1st Canadian Engineers, and you really don't hear about them that much. But for a year, Canada had as a unit a largely indigenous force. And something I forgot to mention about Campbell was he was a fluent Cree and Soto speaker, and actually on parade, because they had such a low percentage of English speakers for a Canadian unit, they had many, many soldiers who actually didn't speak English. They spoke their indigenous language, and he was able to communicate and function, you know, like the unit could function in Cree or Soto. So while not being an officially indigenous unit, it was pretty multicultural. So like I said, at Campbell's death, they lost their champion, and eventually the unit was disbanded. Now, we were talking about those different levels, historical distance. What I'd like to do is, I actually tripped over the story of the 107th in preparation for my kinesiology class, because what I'm very interested in is indigenous traditions in running. And what I found was a whole bunch of very successful runners in the early 20th century. As I tell my students, it was before the internet. People actually watched a marathon, like people running around a hockey rink. Tom Longboat, who is at least Canada's greatest runner, but some people have said he was the most recognizable Canadian in the first two decades of the 20th century, volunteered as a private to be a dispatch carrier at the age of 27. Tom Longboat was an international, like you said, he was an internationally famous runner, athlete. He was 27 years old. He didn't have to do it, but he happily did it. And actually, Longboat was injured twice, and once he was out in the field for so long, he was declared dead. So, that's a sign of probably his goodwill. Here's a sign of Longboat being so famous. He's buying what they call the trench newspaper from a French kid at Arras. Just a couple of images of the Battle at Arras. Another very successful runner, Joe Keeper. He's the grandfather of actress and MP Tina Keeper. Joe Keeper actually came in fourth in the 1912 Stockholm Olympics in the 10,000 meters. The guy who came in second was a Hopi runner named Louis Tiwanima. And also in 1912 was the year Jim Thorpe cleaned up at the Olympics. So 1912 is a very interesting year, because it was probably the last time indigenous athletes got to compete using their traditional skills before, you know, the residential schools destroyed them and all those other things. So Keeper actually winning a Dominion Day race. And these guys were so high-end, they won many, many allied cross-country championships when they weren't fighting. Here's another interesting one that I didn't know until I started this. Oliver Milton Martin, who's number one, the guy with the pipe down the on the bottom left, who's a Six Nations lieutenant in that first image, became a brigadier general in the Second World War. To my knowledge, he's the only indigenous general at the time, anyways. Another very famous athlete, Alex de Coteau. This is a photo of him running and winning by a long shot. You can see there's nobody behind him. The Christmas Day race in Edmonton, I believe this is 1910. De Coteau has a very interesting story. He was the first indigenous police officer in a city police force. He was a sergeant in the Edmonton Police Force, and he was the first officer in the Edmonton Police Force to ride a motorcycle. Like, you know, this is the very early days of motorcycles. Sadly, De Coteau was killed doing his job at the Battle of Passchendaele. And you can just see That's him dressed up in his police uniform there. Now, so there are quite a few other soldiers. I could tell you their lives. But one of the things I was struck with is when those soldiers were out in the field, when they were in uniform, they probably were treated as badly as every other soldier, if you know what I mean. One of the things that really struck me, again, coming at this, I haven't really thought about this for quite a while, was that through the course of the war and the amping up of production for the military effort, for the greater military effort for Canada and for the Empire and for the Allies, was that conditions actually got worse in First Nations communities. And I'll just give you two examples. And you can see this little sign, we're saving you, you save the food. Well-fed soldiers will win the war. Well, one of the things that undermined the well-being of Indigenous communities was something called the Greater Production Campaign. And I told you about William Graham, that white gentleman in the group photo. Well, this was actually William Graham's brainchild, and what he proposed to do, and he actually went into fruition, was they took what they considered to be underused reserve lands and converted them to essentially military farms for the war effort. Now, not surprisingly to some of us who do Indigenous studies, those communities never got their lands back. So as the war is raging, First Nations communities are losing their lands. Another aspect of losing their lands was on the return of the soldiers, the soldier settlement program. And what that was that it gave a break to white soldiers who returned from the front or returned from Europe, and they were provided with homesteads. Well, one of the sources of land for those homesteads was Indian reserves. And actually, just today I came across this, the Treaty Land Entitlement Process in Saskatchewan, which was set up in 1992. One of the reasons it was set up was to get the land back, or to get equivalent back, that was lost in the soldier settlement campaign. How many years ago was that? Like, you know, like that's like 70 or 80 years. Now, another thing, all of these injustices did contribute, and another thing, when First Nations soldiers returned, like I said, they were treated actually as badly as everyone else when they were in their units. When they returned and were decommissioned, they once more fell under the austere terms of the Indian Act. So they became wards of the state, basically had the legal status of children, and they didn't get First Nations people didn't get citizenship and the vote until 1960. So this is another, you know, full generation or more. But having been to Europe, having seen France, whatever that story is, there were some people who were politicized. And one I would just like to leave you with, or tell you about very briefly, was Corporal Joe Drever. And he became the chief of the Mistawasis Reserve in the 1920s. I've heard about Joe Drever, or the Drever case, because on his return from Europe, like I said, he got into banned politics, he took the Canadian government to court with regard to the treaty right to health. And he was able to push that treaty right to health all the way to, I believe it was called the Exchequer Court in 1935. The First Nations people won the treaty right to health care, because what had happened, the Canadian government was charging for medical care from the band's funds, which they didn't have very much. So Drever has actually been a very important pioneer, if you will, in the push for Indigenous rights. Now, I'm done the dance portion of my talk. What I'd like to do is just very briefly, I spent 2 days at the War Museum last week, and I'd just like to share with you a couple images of representations of Indigenous people. Those of us who read Three Day Road, Joseph Boyden's work, will know about Francis Piga Magamau from Perry Island. He was the very famous sniper who got 200 or 300 kills. So he's represented, and that's his chief's bonnet. And so he's represented kind of in his own, he's got his own glass box, so he's represented very highly. But in the contemporary issue, or in the Cold War issue, I found this very interesting. I got a picture of Saddam Hussein and the Fury of Oka side by side. And again, this is the generation of the iPhone. I took a picture of that. And we have another image of Oka, and I believe that's Lasagna, the Mohawk warrior staring down a soldier. But in this contemporary conflicts issue, we have Indigenous people represented as one of the hostiles. And you can see right next to the planes crashing into the Twin Towers. I'm not a semiotics person, but some of you guys can take that. One interesting image I did find, and I didn't know about this painting, but the dioramas at the War Museum, I recommend, even if you're not into military history, go check out the War Museum. It's an architectural marvel. And instead of having paint like dioramas as most museums, what they did was they put paintings behind the artifacts. So they're not trying to, you know, like they've got, they've got art rather than, you know, a cheesy background with, you know, mannequins or whatever. And this is one of the images, The Conquerors by Eric Kennington. And I find this one really interesting. I don't know if you can see the detail on that. It was done in 1920, and it's almost like a different art form than the very patriotic sort of art that was produced during the war. And one of the images, this is one of the few images I saw of an indigenous fighter in that painting. So, and again, people were scandalized that painting because it portrayed dead soldiers marching, and it was actually the victims, right? So I thought that was a very interesting one. So, and that's the mascot of the 107th. So with that, I'll stop talking now. Thanks.